Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and for many years I did live radio. Then I transitioned to the podcast world where I feel I found my home. I love talking about spiritual formation, justice issues, and spiritual practices. Throw in the Enneagram, movies, and current events from time to time, and that's what you get on the podcast. I'm glad you've come along for the ride. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Welcome to Faith Conversations. I'm delighted to have a couple of people with me today. John Lustria back in the co-host seat. John, you've been a regular the last couple of weeks, so welcome to you, okay?
Thank you.
And a very special welcome to the guest of the hour, which is Casper Terkile. We're going to talk about his new book, The Power of Ritual, Turning Everyday Activities into Soulful Practices. But if you're unfamiliar with Casper, and some of you in at Faith Conversations podcast, you know, his name might be a new one for you. So just to let you know, Casper is Harvard Divinity School Fellow and co-host of the award-winning podcast Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. No shock that my son John introduced me to that podcast. And also that hence to Casper, and I've sort of been following what Casper does, and I don't know where. Oh, I think John sent me this too. I happened upon a paper, How We Gather, that just kind of took my breath away, and I think we'll probably touch on that a little bit because of the direction the book goes. So all that said, welcome to Faith Conversations, Casper.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be with you both.
Well, we're excited that you're here. And one of the things I want to ask you about first and foremost, I think it's always interesting to hear how people's books come to be. And especially, this is your first like full-length book, right?
It is.
I know you've done a lot of writing, but...
This is the first time they let me have a whole book. Yeah, exactly. it's so fun to be with you both as a mother and son team, because my dear mentor and teacher, Stephanie Pulsell, one of the professors at Divinity School, told me, you know, everyone's first book, whether it's a chemistry textbook or a spiritual memoir, is about their mother. And my book.
Oh, my gosh. I have a spiritual memoir. My first book with Zondervan in 2010. Oh, this is scary. I'm going to have to leave now and come back. No, I'll think about that later. All right. Carry on. Sorry.
But it's definitely true for me in the sense that I thought I was writing a book around, you know, the changing landscape of spirituality in America, the way in which people can kind of turn their habits into soulful practices by learning about traditional ritual design. And in the end, what I realized was that so much of what I was sharing were things that I had been taught at home without ever really formally being, you know, in a teaching environment, that this is just stuff that I picked up, especially from my mother, because we were a non-religious family. You know, growing up in England, I didn't know anyone who went to church. My parents were actually both Dutch. And I think together with Denmark, Holland is the most secular country in the world. And so religion and any notion of God was completely absent. And so I always assumed my childhood, looking back, was this kind of non-religious atheist even kind of experience. And yet, when I look back at it through the lenses of my divinity school training, I suddenly saw that these rituals and stories and celebrations and really even a liturgical calendar were alive and well in our family, and really that I have my mother to thank for it.
Which I think is always interesting to me, to find out how people end up at divinity school that come from a non-religious background.
Absolutely.
Too. And, you know, just, I mean, that alone, and we'll get into some of that stuff, of course, as we go along. But what about the power of ritual? What moved you this direction? And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this kind of an outgrowth of the How We Gather paper?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's connected, honestly, with your question about how I ended up in divinity school, because as a young person, you know, I went to college and studied history and sociology, but really I studied how to get involved as a young person in activism. That's where my focus was. And I was really engaged in climate change activism, especially mobilizing young people around, you know, the issues of reducing our carbon emissions and ensuring that we're protected and adapting to a climate changing world. And I had put all my eggs in the basket of engaging with politics and policy change, bringing young people to the United Nations, you know, lobbying negotiators in the climate negotiations. And it went nowhere. In 2009, those kind of global talks, which had promised so much, really fell short of what we needed to see. And so I had this kind of total crisis of confidence that the career path that I had chosen and the way of making change that I had chosen, that it just wasn't effective. And I became in that moment really interested in looking at social movements in history and big culture change moments, and kept finding this element of spirituality and religion there, which for me was very strange and uncomfortable even. I came out in high school, my orientation towards religion had always been pretty negative as a gay man. And so when I started to understand more about how inner and outer transformation sit together, that social justice and inner practices and development, that those are the same thing, right, but with different expressions, my mind just exploded. And I was like, where do I go to learn about this? And that's how I ended up in divinity school. And then once I was in the divinity school and learning about these great traditions, because Harvard's divinity school is a very broad and a liberal approach to religious studies. So you're sitting with students who are Hindu, Muslim, you know, Jewish, Christian, nothing. You know, next to me was someone who was a herbalist. Next to her was someone who's going to be a congregational minister. You know, it was a really interesting hodgepodge. But always the conversations in the classroom were pretty oriented towards established congregational structures of religion. And yet when I looked in my own life and the lives of my friends, I could see in fitness communities, in maker spaces, in arts groups, in justice groups, these ostensibly secular communities doing very religious things. And so that's when my colleague Angie Thurston and I went out into the world and just started asking people, especially those who were non-religious, where do you find community? Where do you find a way to do that outer and inner work together? And people started talking about these, you know, these groups that you would never think of as spiritual, but nonetheless, this is where they were going to get married. This is who they were asking for pastoral and spiritual direction. This is the places where they were raising money to support each other through cancer diagnoses, you know, all of these things that you would expect to see in a congregation. And so my work now has kind of landed in this really interesting place between religious tradition and our kind of current more secular world.
So juxtaposed, against that, here I am, a daughter of a Baptist pastor. So I, yes. That's how I grew up, and then spent the majority of my adult life in Christian ministry context in radio. So John kind of raised into that realm, mm-hmm. right? But has had his own path, went on to university, and I'll let him say whatever he wants to say there. That's all. One of the things that I think is interesting early on in the book, one of the things that you talk about, and you just said this, how people are making connections in community.
Yeah.
But stepping back, the why of that, we find ourselves in this world where there is a boatload of loneliness.
Yeah.
So I even look back to 2010 when I did this spiritual memoir, and I didn't think about this until today, doing more reading and prep for the podcast. The first chapter I wrote, I called it Loneliness in the Church.
Wow.
Because at one point in time, I found that space an incredible lonely space, because I hadn't learned how to unmask and be authentic, and the majority of people I was around obviously hadn't either.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so you can be, even in a context that you think ought to have more to offer, and it may not, in fact.
It's one of the things that I think is so important to understand is the difference between social isolation and loneliness. And social isolation, when researchers talk about it, are the structural ways in which we are less connected. So, for example, more people live on their own, more people this environment. more people are separated from a partner. So you have the kind of ways in which we're structurally less connected. But then loneliness is the experience. It's the subjective experience of not having the kind of relationships that we want. So you could be surrounded by people. And I love that example of a congregation, right? Where you're a member, you're involved, but you don't actually feel like anyone knows the authentic you. And honestly, those moments when you're surrounded but still feel lonely can be the most lonely times of all. And I think one of the things that as a culture we're starting to grapple with is the recognition that actually a lot of us experience that sense of loneliness, especially during this COVID moment, and that we're only starting to understand the impact it has on our health. One of the things that really shocked me in researching the book was that, you know, the chronic experience of loneliness has the same impact on our mortality rates. The likeliness that we will die as smoking 15 cigarettes a day or being clinically obese. And so it's not just a kind of, oh, I wish it was different. It's like loneliness can kill us. And so these technologies, these spiritual practices of connection are not just nice to have, but they're real lifesavers, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love kind of one of the big thrusts of the book is drawing on the good of both, you know, religious tradition and this kind of new thing that we're moving towards. And you know, there's a great part in the book where you talk about how, you know, the church or religious institutions have fallen in love with one particular solution to the problem of connection, and that, you know, we can look in other ways and other places. And I think that gets to what I thought was one of the more kind of provocative ideas in the book, is that we need to fundamentally rethink what is sacred. So talk a little bit about that.
There's so much in here, John. You're getting at the juicy stuff. So there's perhaps two different concepts that I want to touch on here. One is that I was, you know, raised with the assumption that when we look out into the world, there are some places that are sacred and that there are some places that are, you know, secular. And so, okay, a church building is a holy place and the supermarket is, you know, a place of the market, or it's a, you know, it's a secular place. And so very quickly, if you navigate around the world and you don't go into those sacred spaces, the assumption is that there's just no sacredness in your life, right? That it's just over there. It's not for someone like me. And it's not for someone like me, maybe because I'm not interested or it just doesn't vibe with me, or because I'm not welcome there, right? So there's a whole analysis that we can have about who is welcome in those spaces. So that's one way of looking at it and the way I just assumed. But what the more I learned about religious tradition was that actually it's a much more helpful way. Instead of seeing these kind of vertical lines that, you know, here is a sacred line, here's a secular line, if you turn them on their side and you see them kind of as an equal sign, right? Or as these lines that are horizontal, that most of the time in our day, you know, we're doing our to-do list, we're picking up the kids from school, we're cooking dinner, blah, blah, blah. We're living a life where we're kind of on the surface. But that at any moment, and especially through the power of ritual, we can drop down into something that's richer and deeper. And it's in that place that sacredness lives. And so suddenly the conception of who has access to the sacred is much more democratized. And it's actually about building our own capacity and building relationships and opportunities to go deep and to access that experience of sacredness. That for me was revolutionary because it suddenly meant, it's not only in a church or in a synagogue or in a mosque that we can access that sense of sacredness, that it's available to us all the time.
Yeah, I always think everything is sacred, but I grew up with the same divide, totally the same divide. I think of a moment really when, John, you were like 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there. And I would bring this candle into your room every night and we would do the examine, right? And
wow.
I would, so for a 6-month period, I journaled what John said at that age and what I said. So I have this journal and some nights it's like, so in my tradition, people will recognize this, you know, some nights it was like, I need to slip my feet out of my shoes because I'm standing on holy ground.
Yes.
This little bedroom of this 8, 9, 10-year-old was sacred space, right? Yeah.
Oh, that just makes me want to cry. That is such a beautiful practice. And then to have that written record still, I mean, what a document.
Yeah.
I had actually forgot. I haven't thought about that in a long time.
Yeah, I came across it just the other day. I need to photocopy.
Yeah, so you should send me some of those. I'd be curious to,
I will.
To read them.
Yeah.
And this isn't, you know, this isn't revolutionary stuff. Often the best ideas that we get to when we think about these things are actually some of the most orthodox. You know, if you think of John Calvin in Geneva, where he's the one saying, I want to break open these monastic walls because people are starting to think it's only there that God lives. I want everyone to experience this, right? That's the idea behind congregational singing, that it's not just the priests, but it's all the people. And so these ideas, I think they just calcify over time, and we have to rediscover them again.
Totally.
We get to have our John Calvin moment.
Totally. Well, I'm sitting here going, preach. I mean, the things that are quoted, John Calvin quotes, are not that. You know, it's other stuff.
He only burnt one guy.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Well, so what... So I've kind of had this idea for a long time, and like, you know, people think about it for, you know, more than 5 minutes, they're like, oh yeah, you know, of course everything's spiritual, it makes sense. But what I love about the power of ritual is it's sort of putting, this maybe isn't the right metaphor, but it's kind of putting teeth into that idea that like, oh, everything is spiritual and here's how we can experience it as such. Kind of very particular practices, and I love that about it.
Oh, John, I love that you picked up on that, because my whole orientation for the book is that I wanted to start by affirming people's experience. So to start by saying, you know, that moment when you're in the shower and you whisper to yourself the things you hope for, right? That's worthy, and that can be the beginning of a spiritual practice. Or, you know, the sweatshirt that you've kept from your granddad that you've never wanted to throw away, right? Like that can be a sacred practice. So to affirm the things people are already doing, even if they don't quite know why, but then, as you said, to put some teeth behind it. And for me, that's about putting these practices and longings in conversation with tradition, and to say, okay, we're not the first people to have thought these things or had these experiences. What can we learn from Abraham Joshua Heschel? What can we learn from Thomas Merton and Simone Weil? And because for me, I had never heard of these people until I came to divinity school. You know, I wasn't raised with those resources. And I wanted to open the door in the same way that it had been opened for me and say, look, meet these yes. fabulous thinkers and practitioners, because the wisdom that they shared is relevant in your life today.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was something I was thinking about. Obviously, you know, your book is a great way to access this. Everyone go buy it. so that's a great place to start. But it got me thinking, you know, we kind of throw the phrase religious tradition around. You know, if someone's like, oh, this is all very interesting, I would love to figure out some religious tradition or orthodoxy that I would love to get in touch with. Do you have any like resources that you might point people to? Because I think sometimes it can feel inaccessible, like it's very old. You need to go to an archive somewhere.
Right. Right. And honestly, I will say, you know, not every moment needs to be ritualized, right? You don't have to have a PhD to be able to do this kind of thing. And so I really focus on maybe a handful of practices. You know, introducing people to the idea of what a Sabbath is about, reconfiguring how we understand prayer, thinking about pilgrimage in a different way. So I try and introduce just a handful and to start there. But no doubt, when people are interested in going further, one of the things that I recommend in the book that for me was transformational, and Anita, I'm so glad to know that you're a spiritual director, is to seek out someone who can accompany you. You know, and it might start just in a sort of accompaniment model where someone asks questions and listens. They're not even giving you specific practices yet or giving you reading recommendations, but over time it might grow into that kind of relationship. And it's just the most wonderful thing to have someone in that kind of care of souls role, someone who's there just to witness and accompany you as you're going into that deeper journey, and who can recommend specific practices that will be helpful to you, rather than feeling like you have to, you know, understand every tradition.
I love that, because as a trained historian, I was like, oh yeah, I'm sure there's lots of great websites people can go look at, and I'm certain there are. But that's such a great idea, because it's talking about that kind of connection, whether you're bringing in sort of a mentor, or even, you know, if you have a fellow or a companion mm-hmm. that you can go on the journey with. So I love that you've pointed us there, because that's not at all where my mind was going.
Well, and which my mind was going here, that I grew up in this stream that was very word and mind oriented. Mm. So when spiritual practices began being introduced to me, it was like my world lit on fire. Yeah. I mean, I came to life. I was just kind of bogging down, and everything was old, dead, and tired. Not that some of those rituals weren't good in and of themselves, but over time they had become stale, and I just had nowhere to go. No one, until someone entered my life and just kind of pulled the curtain back again.
And I think that's a common experience, especially for people who were raised within Christian traditions in America specifically. You know, we really equate here in the US religion with belief. And that comes from a very kind of Christocentric understanding of what religion is, right? The classic question, have you accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, right? That's the ultimate test. But when we look beyond Protestantism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, honestly, even Catholicism, religious identity is much more shaped by what we practice, yes, by than what we believe. So you can have a Jewish friend who might say, you know, I'm Jewish, but I'm not religious. And it points to the fact that what marks out their Judaism is the food they eat, the songs they sing, the celebrations they mark during the year, the relationship with peoplehood and ancestry. So there's many, many different ways in to think about what religious means, which for me left a really interesting question, because I'm not a member of a congregation. My spiritual life is a mishmash of, you know, some Anglican stuff that I grew up with in England, some Dutch summer camp things, you know, a little pagan ritual, and now like Jewish theology that I've come to love. And so I'm sitting here and I'm like, well, I'm not religious per se, but then when you look at it through that practice lens and I look at how I live my life, I'm like, I'm super religious, but the place where the institution lives now and my individual experience is are quite far apart. And this is honestly one of the dangers, I think, within the kind of personal journey exploration, is that we find things that really work for us as individuals, but it's never really shared with anyone else. And so we still end up in that place of loneliness, even though it might be spiritually rich. And I think this is one of the biggest design challenges, as it were, both for religious institutions, but also for people like us who are exploring together, is what are the structures of commitment and connection that we can build anew? And my sense is that they will be smaller. It might be oriented around small groups or home-based things, family. It's not going to be at the size of a congregation necessarily. I think interesting things are happening in the workplace. But that's one of the big questions for me as we look to the future of religious community, is what is going to be the structure and shape of that kind of spiritual connection, even when we don't have the same beliefs necessarily?
Well, and don't you think, you know, you've got COVID-19 that is maybe even fast tracking some of this.
Absolutely.
There, I mean, if religious leaders aren't thinking about it, they better be, because things are shifting. They are changing. I don't see things going back. I don't think things should go back to just the way they were.
Right? Absolutely. I mean, and the data suggests that people agree with you. In England, there was a survey recently that said only 9% of the population wanted things to go back as they were, that there was a real sense of, do we have to live like this? Is this what we want? You know, and that might be about the kind of overwork culture that we have, or the great inequalities that exist within our economy. You know, it could be all sorts, right, of things, but there's a sense that we don't want it to be like this. I mean, one other piece I think of a future kind of religious infrastructure, if we can use that word, are things like media and podcasts, because we're actually able to have an intimate conversation with one another, and I get to listen to you, mm-hmm, and feel part of that conversation, even though we're not in the same room. Right. So I think technology is also really mediating how this is going to change in the future.
Totally. I mean, I'm online with small groups I live in Florida, and if you know anything about Florida, there are snowbirds that live half the year,
right,
you know, up north, and half the year here. Well, you know what? Small group all summer has been able to continue on because we couldn't be in person anyway. We're right online on Zoom, and the community still exists where it would have just kind of puff gone away, mm-hmm, in the summer. One of the things I want to get to, and John, you can maybe go from here, wherever you want to go, but In the book, you talk about connecting with yourself, connecting with the people around you, connecting with the natural world, connecting with the transcendent. And you know, we may not necessarily get to all of those things, but I wanted to at least mention so that people know the holistic nature of where you're going with this conversation in the book.
Yeah, I really try and organize the book in a way that we can think about, you know, in this time of disconnection, what are some strategies that help us feel really connected? And particularly to find rituals of connection at each of those different levels. Very often when we talk about connection, we just think about other people, but I think it's multi-layered, right? That we really experience belonging when we also feel our authentic self, when we feel like we belong to a place and to even an ecology, and then to something bigger than ourselves, right? That sense of transcendence of being at home in the world. And so for each of those chapters, I look at some ancient practices and how they're being kind of reimagined and reinvented for this time. And honestly, I think it's such an interesting, it offers a playbook, I hope, to the reader to think about what are the ways in which I feel connected to, you know, my local environment? What are the ways I feel connected? What are the moments when I feel connected to myself or my family? So it's kind of an invitation to reflect on, yeah, where do I experience connection? And if there's bits missing, how can I maybe build in some more ritual to build that?
And I probably would be remiss, John, and I know you were just about to ask a question, but I think I might be remiss if I don't ask you to talk a little bit about Harry Potter as a sacred text, because, you know, John, I mean, John is likely age 20, he's 27. He is likely not the target audience of this podcast, even though he appears on it, you know, with some frequency. And so my guess is that people listening to the podcast aren't really fully aware of what Harry Potter and the Sacred Text is. And they're sitting there going, I hope to goodness you say something before the end of this so I know what on earth that is. And also to talk more broadly about what it looks like to engage a text that we might not look at and call sacred as a sacred text.
So, and I'll just add on to that. Well, first of all, if you're under the age of 30 and listening to this podcast, write in to a producer at Anita. What's your email?
AnitaLustria.com. Producer at AnitaLustria.com.
just to add on to that, what I was going to ask, and this can be a great answer to the question. We've talked a lot about ritual, but let's get specific with at least one example, and then we can we'll let you hit on the buzzwords that you're legally obligated to talk about with this book of intention, attention, and repetition.
Absolutely, yeah, and maybe I'll start with that one, because that the idea of the book is to, as I said, to help people take things they're already doing and deepen it into a spiritual practice. So I don't want people to feel like, oh, here's another thing I have to do on the to-do list. But to say, no, actually the moment when you put on moisturizer, or the moment before a meal, or the snuggling with your kid before bedtime, like those are all moments that are latent with sacredness. And the way in which we can kind of deepen them into what we might call a spiritual practice or a spiritual ritual is through these three elements. And for me, intention is really that powerhouse of setting a sense of what do I want to connect with by practicing this. You know, it's not just fulfilling a function, right? Brushing your teeth to have a good oral hygiene. That's more a habit or a routine. But when we add a layer of meaning or a layer of symbolic, you know, intention to it, it elevates it or it deepens it, so it becomes more meaningful. So you might say, you know, I want to cultivate gratitude, or I want to do this practice so I cultivate courage. Or it might be, I want to remember, you know, my late father, or I want to really focus my awareness and send my love out to people who are, you know, crossing, you know, the border in great difficulty, you know, whatever, something bigger than yourself that you're setting that intention towards. So that's the first thing. Then, and this is maybe my favorite, is to think about ways of paying attention while you're practicing. And this is where we can really dig into what you were saying, Anita, of embodied practices, things that are not just about our rational brain or the words that we use, but that draw on, you know, the five senses. What can we hear? What can we see? What can we touch and taste and feel? So that we can really present our kind of yeah make our awareness really present. And so this is why, and often in religious rituals, you have incense, or you have beautiful music, or you have, you know, icons. They're all ways of helping us be present in the moment. So that's the kind of the second element of making that ritual, is to find a way to pay attention while you're doing it. And then finally, repetition. So repeat it over time. I like to say that rituals are not just decorative, right? They're not just there to make our life more beautiful, though we love that, but they are formative. Right, that these are practices of formation, so that by practicing these rituals, we become the kind of person that we want to be. And so that's why that kind of triptych of intention, attention, and repetition is so important. So let's use a real world example. In the Harry Potter and the Sacred Text podcast, we really think about kind of ritualizing the way that we read books that we love. And very often when we think about a sacred text, we're thinking about the Bible, we're thinking about the Quran or the Torah. And here comes my theology, so you'll have to agree with this or disagree with this. But in my understanding of sacredness, it's not necessarily that there is a God on high who ordains a particular text as sacred, right? Or maybe who divinely inspires it or who classifies it as sacred. But a text becomes sacred when a community returns to it again and again and offers it the most heartfelt questions, right? When generation after generation, we come back to a story, and we say, we trust this story to help us understand what it means to be human and how to live a good life in service of others. And so when we think about Harry Potter, although it's only 20 years old, there are millions of people who already turn to this book, not just for solace after a loved one has died or even ritually, you know, it's the beginning of the new year, I'm going to reread all 7 books, or for comfort, you know, as they fall asleep every night listening to the audiobook.
But John, these
sorry. Yeah, that's what I did quite a bit.
And you're not alone, John. I mean, so many of us are oriented around these stories, and the characters in them represent, you know, ways that we want to be or don't want to be in the world, right? That they symbolize the potential of who we can be. And if I ask you, what house are you in? You know, everyone will have an answer to that. You know,
Hufflepuff.
Slytherin.
No.
I actually have to say that the podcast, I always thought I was a Ravenclaw, but the podcast convinced me I was a Hufflepuff. Ah. So thanks for
you
that.
You upgraded. Oh.
That's great.
Anyway.
But all of that is to say, you know, the fandom is already using this text, right? Things like the Harry Potter Alliance mobilize people to engage with justice issues and using the story of Harry Potter and the characters to motivate people to take real world action. So all of that was the background. So the rituals that we practice are specific textual practices. So in the Christian tradition, we have practices like Lectio Divina, or we have, you know, the Ignatian idea of imagining yourself into the story. We draw also on Jewish textual practices like Chavruta and Pardes, which for me, you know, before coming to Divinity School, I had never heard of any of these things. And so it was a whole new way of reading, not to read a book because it's interesting and fun as a fan or as a, you know, student of literature, but to use these texts as a mirror to help us understand our own lives, to dig deeper into questions of ultimate meaning. So the intention that we set with every episode in the podcast is to read it through a theme. So we might read it through a theme like love or resentment or charity. And then we find ways to pay attention to the text by using these textual practices. So Lectio Divina is one of my favorite because we adapt Guido II's great little pamphlet, which I highly encourage everyone to read. This is for the historians amongst us, like John. It's this lovely little pamphlet where he's instructing someone, you know, in the 14th century to climb the ladder of monks, which for him are these 4 reflections to dig deeper into a text and to ascend into the heavens. And so the 4 questions we ask are, first of all, we pick a sentence and then say, what's happening in this sentence narratively? You know, very simple, the way we usually read it. Then we ask, what allegorical images or stories or songs, movies are we reminded of? So this is a moment of really opening our awareness to allow our kind of creative juices to get flowing. And Guido, this monk from many centuries ago, imagined it as putting a grape into your mouth and biting into it and the juices exploding into your mouth, which I just love that.
Nice, yeah.
So then for the 3rd question, we ask, what in my own life am I reminded of in this piece of text? So we make it personal, we bring it home. And then finally, traditionally, the fourth step is to think about, what is God calling me to do, having read this text, having gone through this reflection? The way that we ask it on the podcast, to be extremely kind of inclusive, is to say, what is the text asking of me? And so what happens is that you move from a story about a wizard boy, discovering the wizarding world, and you end up thinking about wanting to reconciliate with your sister who you've not spoken to for a year, right?
Yes.
Or we've had listeners calling in saying, I finally made the decision to adopt a child, or whatever it is. And so it's an amazingly powerful example, I think, of using a very old school ritual, but finding a way to bring it to what people are already doing.
Yes.
And helping people live lives of meaning and purpose.
Which, I hear that and I go, oh, I want that for the Christian church, my tradition. You know, I want that so badly. You know, I have that and I work at introducing it, certainly. But yeah, I just desperately want that. And so I just, kudos to what you do. I just love what you do with Harry Potter.
You might say blessings to you.
Yes, thank you, John. Sorry about that. Yeah, you're right.
I love it. Well, Anita, honestly, we've had ministers and rabbis write in saying, I had never thought about engaging text in this way. I'm going to change the way I do religious education. We're going to use it for our sermon series.
Great.
You know, so, and the irony is, you know, I learned it from a Christian minister, right? Like, I learned it. So we're all just helping each other out here.
Yeah, isn't that the truth, right?
Oh, well, yeah. At the end of the day, and this is my Enneagram type 9 speaking here, but we're all on the same team.
Well, here's my Enneagram 3, as long as I'm winning.
Here's my healthy Enneagram 3. Whatever I can do to elevate what you do at Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, I'm happy to do.
Oh, I'm glad you're here, Anita. We'd be lost without you.
It's just that I'm a lot older than you. That's all. Oh, okay. Oh, that's funny.
But I honestly, the Enneagram is another great example to look to. I mean, it is exploding in popularity right now because I think it offers people a way, both in terms of self-understanding and inquiry, but also to allow themselves, especially secular people who maybe especially on the political left, who are suspicious of religion, to find a way to bring spirituality into their life in a way that feels safe. And so whether it's astrology, whether it's crystals, you know, or whether it's the Enneagram, there's a real hunger, I think, for tools that help people make meaning. And there's an opportunity, I think, there for folks who have some religious background and training to be of real service.
For sure.
You mentioned the political left, you know, I love your kind of bring in, like, you know, that idea of resistance that they might have to. What about those, you know, more conservative folks? What would you say to them who are perhaps a little resistant to this whole idea?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, John, part of my work is to say, I'm really clear about who I'm serving. And I know I'm not going to be of use to everyone. And so my work really focuses on people who are outside of religious institutions. My approach, if people are happy in their congregation, in their denominational life, if it's helping them live a life of justice and purpose, go get them. You know, like, I'm not going to be much help for you, but I'm going to cheer you on. And so, I definitely, you know, we can have theological conversations out of interest and exploration. That's one thing. But I'm definitely not seeking to convince anyone to, you know, abandon their church or anything. Not at all. But I'm also really clear that my job is not to say to, you know, the unaffiliated millennial, go join a synagogue, go join a congregation. So it's kind of walking a middle path between those two things for me.
Sure.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, to encourage people to go, and I think you borrowed this term from somebody else, go ritual spotting in your own life.
Yes, it's great.
Which I just love that turn of phrase. That was so nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my friend Koshat Ozenk, who runs the Stanford Ritual Design Lab, which is just such a cool thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, for him, it's a similar question of, you know, he's engaging a student body that's very secular. But once people started developing their own kind of morning coffee ritual or like a commuting ritual, very quickly they would move to rituals that were oriented around spirituality and meaning in a way that he was very surprised by. So again, I think it just points to the fact that people are hungry in this moment.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. And especially in the, we mentioned COVID earlier, but especially in the you know, the age of physical separation from so many.
Yeah.
You know, 46% of Gen Zs, so folks under the age of 22, have tried out a new religious or spiritual practice since the beginning of lockdown. 46%. So it's a real moment of reorienting, I think. You're exactly right.
Wow.
And I find, you know, books like these, ideas like these so interesting because and we spoke to it a little bit earlier. I really do get this sense that we're in this, you know, spiritual evolution turning point. I don't even know what the right language is, but something's changing. And I'm just so curious, you know, what's next. And I find all of this very interesting.
And thank you for mentioning that, John, because we've mentioned, you know, COVID-19. We haven't even said anything about the racial stuff that's going on after the killing of George Floyd and protests and marches. And yeah, I mean, that's another piece that has come at just at this same time. I mean, wow. I don't know what you want to say about that.
I think you're exactly right. Absolutely. And the way in which the Black Lives Matter movement is actually a very spiritual movement is super interesting to me. The first thing we should say is that it is long overdue, especially that white people are supporting racial justice in the way that we've seen over the last few months is heartening. And of course, there's a long way to go. But as I say, in the same way that we've seen spirituality show up in interesting ways in fitness groups and in arts groups and even in the workplace, spirituality is really at the heart of how I understand the Black Lives Matter movement, the way in which rituals are practiced, both kind of in and during protests on the streets, but also the way in which the leaders are very directly engaging ancestral practices, especially practices with African ancestral origin. You know, the burning of sage, the words like ashe that are being said as kind of an amen on the streets. There's really interesting and beautiful ways in which I think spirituality is living and these spiritual practices and these rituals are living in the movement for Black Lives, which we know is, you know, one of the things that for movements to sustain themselves over time, you need that inner and outer connection. And I think folks are doing that extraordinarily beautifully.
One of the things that I realize in a conversation like this, when I look at the clock, I'm like, seriously, this amount of time cannot have already passed. I want this conversation just to keep going and realize that it can't and that we're barely scratching the surface of what's in the power of ritual. But one of my questions for you is about your hope for what you've written. I mean, writing a book takes a long time. There's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that go into, you know, what you put on the page. And then I'm sure that the Harry Potter and the Sacred Text folks have turned out and hopefully purchased this. But, you know, you want to get it into the hands of people. But then you have your own personal wish and dream and desire for this. What's your hope?
Oh, Anita, that's such a beautiful, generous question. You know, the phrase that I have in my mind is about more and more of us feeling a sense of spiritual permission, the sense that we each have the agency and the creativity and honestly the inherent worthiness and goodness to translate some of these ancient traditions and to find ways in which they can live in a healthy way in our own lives. And so that's kind of the first hope is that we each feel a sense of spiritual permission to be creative and even playful with these beautiful traditions to which I think we are all inheritors. And then the second thing, and honestly, this is as much to myself as to any reader, which is, and I really dig into this at the end of the book, which is to remind us that each of these rituals and these practices and all of the great traditions in their own way, they're not creating a sense of connection. They're helping us remember the connection that's already there.
Yes.
And that for me is so hard to remember because everything in our lives kind of points us to think of ourselves as just an individual or, you know, just one piece in the machine, but to instead think of these rituals as ways of reminding ourselves that we are already inherently part of one another. And that when we see ourselves in that way, a whole new set of possibilities come to mind, from the way in which we make policy, from the way in which we engage the natural world, right? It has so many practical implications.
Yes.
But it also changes the way we treat each other. And so if there's anything, I hope that that's one of the things that this book can help us remember.
Nice. Well, I know it was a treat for John and I, you know, reading through the book and to be able to talk with you here today. And I do hope, I would love to hear from people. You know, I think there's a lot of things that were talked about today. There are a lot of thoughtful possibilities here, and would love to hear more from people. You can always email us here, producer@anitalustria.com. Casper, thank you. Just really a joy to have you. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks, John, for thinking of me and Anita for this conversation. It's just a real pleasure to meet you both.
And absolutely. As always, I say to everyone listening, keep the conversation going.